Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody, welcome to Writers on Film. This is a special episode to look at Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. We're going to talk a little bit about Dunkirk, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the comic book movies that have come out in the past summer, and those which are slated to come out in the future, with our sort of resident expert, James Peaty, who is himself a writer who has written widely for comic books, Doctor Who, 2000 AD, a bunch of places too long for me to remember, as well as being a script writer and a playwright. I think was the last time we talked to you. You just had a play come on.
Well, a short thing. I wouldn't call myself a playwright.
Okay.
I've written some bits for theatre.
You see, and that's not how you do it, James. You've got to pump up your CV.
You don't.
I mean, like, if Steven Spielberg walks past you in the corridor, he's your executive producer. That's how it works.
This is true.
So just before we came on mic, James was talking to me about a recent cinema experience, which is Blue Beetle, which is the new DC comic book film, which apparently is not very good. James, what did you think?
It's not very good, is it? I mean, I don't think that's really a surprise. When if you look at the kind of the lack of success for this film, it was just a very strange thing. I took my daughter and I to see it. You know, she's 10, and she just sort of said to me about, we went to see it in the central town. We went to see it at Pitch House Central. She liked that cinema, so that was kind of part of the trip. We were going to go to town, and she said to me, if we hadn't spent the money, we could have walked out.
And that's a 10-year-old.
Yeah, it's a 10-year-old. And she just said it was, it was awful. I mean, I think it was just so derivative. And so, I've got a bit of skin in the game as well. I wrote a version of that character for DC back in the day. When I wrote Supergirl, he was one of the characters that was in the run that I had. Although I must admit, he was given to me because I took that book over and he was already kind of part of the deal. So, I know that character. I worked for DC for a number of years, well, across the line. And so I have kind of views. But it just summed up everything that was kind of wrong with the current approach to all of those properties. And if you look at it across the kind of course of the year, massive failure of Shazam earlier in the year, which was wasn't a great film, wasn't a terrible film. I thought, didn't think it was as bad as it as the reviews. It was certainly, it was a good half hour too long, as everything is. Mm. And that was kind of sort of thrown onto the fire. I thought The Flash, I enjoyed The Flash as a fan of, you know, that character. And I thought they did quite good, interesting things with Batman and that. But again, it's a perfect example of kind of corporate meddling and no clear direction. I think that film was made under three different regimes, instigated, executed, and then delivered under different, completely different management structures and different desires for the company. And then you come to this, which was obviously created, it was created as like an HBO Max film, a direct-to-video film, basically, which was upgraded to a theatrical release. And you look at it and you think, why bother? Why bother? I mean, it's just shocking. But I don't know. I think that the generally across the board, I think apart from a few exceptions, the it speaks to a bigger problem within Hollywood, of which, you know, I think what we're going to talk about later on is a bit taps into, is kind of the exhaustion of the blockbuster. I mean, I thought Blue Beetle was completely, you know, generic and derivative, and it was like, it so this bit's like Ant-Man, this bit's like Spy Kids, because it's kind of Hispanic kind of character, you know, playing with the kind of with the sort of the cultural tropes there. That you've got stuff from Spider-Man, you've got a bit of Iron Man thrown in, and there's no more kind of like creative approach than that. Let's shovel that together. It's not a badly directed film, it's quite nicely done in certain places, but it's just completely generic. And there's no, you look at it, it costs $120 million. Why did they think they were going to make that money back? It's just crazy. But I think across the board, I've seen a lot of stuff this summer because of childcare and all the rest of it. And some of them I'm genuinely interested in. I mean, I mean, if you go from like that Transformers film through to Mission Impossible, the latest Mission Impossible film as well, I just think they all are completely tired through the emotions. And if you look at the films that have kind of done well in that area, you know, the kind of Guardians of the Galaxies and the Spider-Mans, they're very different. They're more creative. They're more imaginative. They're more, they take a few risks. You know, they do, you know, within the kind of the what you can do within a blockbuster. But those are the ones that have resonated. And you look at the other ones that are like continuing flat. I mean, Indiana Jones is a perfect example.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, one thing I would, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And one of the things that irked me a little bit about that film was the fact that the preposition is the only thing that is different from the first film. It's not Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse, it's across the. I think, wow, is that, you know, is that how we're gonna, you know, even just scrolling through a menu to try to find it is kind of difficult because it's. But the second thing is, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good fun, and I didn't finish it because I kind of knew where it was going, and I enjoyed the first like hour or so, and after a while, it was just like having sugar rush followed by moments of sentimentality, followed by another sugar rush, followed by another bit of sentiment, and it felt like the bits where he was, you know, you've got to tell your parents who you really are bits, and we're going to have a really weird chase with great visuals and all the rest of it, felt like they were just totally different films directed by different people, which obviously they kind of are in the structure of how these kinds of films work, but felt really detached.
I've seen it twice and I enjoyed it both times. I enjoyed it more the second time, I think, actually. I think it's more, and I think that the kind of the coming out scene, so to speak, has a quite a good, if you didn't get to the end, has a kind of good little twist as it gets to the end of the film. I think it's too long.
Again, yeah.
And I think the first film is kind of like a perfect sort of version of what that should be. But I like the way that, I mean, I think where you could, with the criticism you can have of it, which is the truth of other films like of that, you know, the Flash as well plays with this, is that you're talking about films that are only concerned with their own internal sort of mythology. They really have no, there's no other kind of, I think what was interesting in the first sort of Spider-Verse was that you take Spider-Man and you kind of like you're broadening the kind of the legend of it. You're making it kind of, you're doing this, what you've always done, which is, just, you know, the Miles Morales character isn't really that different from Peter Parker.
Right.
Really. I mean, there are differences, but it's just, it's kind of remixed a little bit more in different ways, isn't it? But with this, you're kind of like, you are playing this, you're playing the same notes, but I think there's a lot of really kind of good stuff in it and a lot of really imaginative stuff in it. And I think in terms of it sort of drilling deeper into the kind of what it's based on that mythology, with that kind of like backstory, all that kind of stuff, I think it does it really, really well. But it, you can't do that too often. Also, I think the trouble with a lot of properties is they do it. I think Spider-Man is one of the few that you can do that to, because Spider-Man, like Batman, is a character that has had really lots of very different and very strong kind of interpretations artistically down the years, and in terms of cinema as well. So, you know, right. There aren't many characters other than Batman I can think of where you've got three, you know, really successful live action incarnations. You've got a really successful animated incarnation. You've got a version of the character that's really famous in kind of video games as well. So there aren't many that have that kind of 360 degree sort of like cultural footprint.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up there with Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, you know, as...
Well, they kind of are. I mean, and I think in a lot of ways, if you look at the failure of the Dracula films that have come out this year too, that have tanked, haven't they?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have thought that you'd get another Sherlock Holmes film out that would be particularly successful. In a way, they've supplanted those characters as they're the sort of 21st century versions in other media that, you know, have their roots in the 20th century, much like those characters are 19th century characters that then kind of dominated the 20th century media landscape. I think that's kind of where they are. Which kind of is interesting as well when you then consider a character like James Bond, who I think is a kind of very interesting inflection point in their history, where I'm not sure whether what they do next will really make much impact.
I think they're going to have to do something, because I've been thinking of a rewatch of Dirty Harry, the series. They're not great movies. The first one's a great movie. The second one is a really good movie. And then you're sort of, you know, really declining returns. But I'm kind of interested in the idea of looking at a character through the course of a decade and a half and just seeing how he becomes, you know, how he changes and how the world around him is changing. And there's no sense that anybody yet has thought, hey, you know what we really need is an updated Dirty Harry. He seems to be a character who's very locked in the world that was those two decades. But with James Bond, he's already survived, 40, 50 years now?
60.
And 60 years, you know. You could imagine a reinvention. You could imagine him going through something quite radical, maybe getting a younger actor than is normal, but there is a huge risk in doing that. I mean, I felt that with Indiana Jones, because with the last Indiana Jones, the one before this one, there was a real sense that there was a possibility Shia LaBeouf was going to take over the character, we were going to get a bunch of mutt films. which didn't. But it's like, no, we're just going to keep Harrison Ford. And when he's gone, this is it. And I don't know. I don't think there's going to be any further exploration. You really hated the latest iteration.
What, of Indiana Jones?
Yeah.
I just thought it was a badly conceived film. I mean, I think you can't get away from, I think there's some scenes in it that are quite good. I think there's the bits in New York at the beginning are all right. The minute it becomes an Indiana Jones film, it just falls apart, because you're dealing with the problem of an 80-year-old man who can't do anything. And that's not what anyone watches Indiana Jones films for. Even in like the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, they do at least a passable job of faking the fact that he's in the middle of the action. And he is still in the middle of the action for quite a lot of it. You know, he's fighting that big Russian at the end, you know, face to face, having a big fist fight. Mm. In that opening kind of sequence in the Area 51 in Roswell, he's like hanging off of things and he's using his brain and he's kind of opening shells and there's magnetized containers and all the rest of it. And it's like, that's an Indiana Jones film. in this, you've got the kind of beginning where he kind of seems to, he's sort of a digital Indiana Jones that doesn't seem to be worried about the weight of physics. You know, he can be hung by his neck and not die in the first 5 seconds. And then afterwards, I mean, and it's just, the whole thing felt kind of overly manicured. And also as well, I just think it looked like a film that was just been pre-vis to death. You plug all the bits in together where you got him in close up and you do this. And then he breaks his shoulder during the film.
Mm.
And then at the end, he's shot in the shoulder and he's lying down for like the last half an hour or whatever. And it's like, sort of, that's not really what anyone wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but also I thought that the whole thing of the MacGuffin and everything. And I think Indiana Jones is an interesting one because Indiana Jones kind of approaches, I think it speaks to a broader problem with the whole thing about franchises now and where Hollywood is with them, is that they, the original four film, I mean, I will include the original four films, the four films that are produced by George Lucas and directed by Steven Spielberg, regardless of what your view of any of them is creatively, whether which one's your favorite, which one's the worst, whatever, each one is about a kind of set of ideas and beliefs. And Indiana Jones approaches those beliefs and those ideas, that relic, that MacGuffin, as if it is real. So we approach the Judeo-Christian stuff in Raiders of the Lost. I guess Raiders of the Lost Ark is more Judaism. Last Crusade's more Christianity. You've got the Indian Hindu stuff in Temple of Doom, and then you've got the kind of sci-fi sort of Crystal Skull kind of stuff. But in all of those, they approach them as if they're a real thing.
Mm.
And the rules of that are kind of applied quite rigorously to how they engage with those things. This was like, you've got a dial that doesn't, which is sort of vaguely exists, but doesn't really exist. Archimedes did not travel through time. And it's just sort of there. It's kind of a MacGuffin that's there that's allows us to do this last bit, which is just like, it basically looked like Horrible Histories. That's what I thought when I watched it. It was kind of, and there's a thing where you got Nazis kind of in sort of ancient Greece or whatever it was. Was it ancient Greece?
It was Sicily. It was Sicily. That they were trying to, you know, they were flying over in a scene where everybody's running around inside a plane, and I couldn't tell what anybody wanted to actually do.
But that's a great, that, in a way, that's a kind of great sort of pulp idea. If it's done well, you could say I could have fun, but it becomes... But it's a bit Iron Sky. It's not Indiana Jones.
Yes, yes. Iron Sky is a brilliant. I didn't think of that at the time, but that's an absolutely perfect example. But
that's kind of like, you know, it's a kind of fundamental misunderstanding in a way of Indiana Jones, because I think what you've got there is you've got a film that plays to the actor's idea of what the character is, but the actual creative people are no longer part of the equation.
Mm, yeah.
So what makes Harrison happy? Well, he gets to do some scenes with Indy where he's an old man, and there's some okay moments with that, but that's not an Indiana Jones film. So I think with that, you're then playing on the wrong... It's very much like the Star Wars sequels. You know, they take all... They don't really understand what they're making.
Mm,
mm. They know they've got a brand that they can sell.
I mean, if anything, I think the post original trilogy, I mean, even the prequels are not, in retrospect, are not bad. Just in the way Kingdom of Crystal Skull, I'm more willing to say there are a quartet of films that are more or less the same, even though different quality, obviously, but live in the same world. After I saw the fifth one, what was the films that we were talking about that I've just had a brain freeze? Star Wars, yeah. When I saw Tatooine and I saw Luke, he's a farmhand. He's relatable. He could be dropped out of a Larry McMurtry novel. He could be in the last picture show. He's going to the local town, which is miles away from his farm. All of those things are... This is a place where nothing happens. If you read the Alan Dean Foster novelization, he's watching the space battle through his binoculars up in the upper atmosphere. And, beyond the upper atmosphere, out in space. Everything that's come
after that, including the cartoons and the TV series and the J.J. Abrams reboot, everything that comes after that is telling you that Tatooine is like practically the center of the universe, where everything is happening all the time. Obi-Wan Kenobi doesn't live in a hut where he's been retired for 40, 50 years. He's been having adventures and then you're popping back to the hut. And that's just like... that completely spoils the idea of the original film. You know what longer you've polluted that atmosphere.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the, I don't have a problem with the Obi-Wan thing. By that point, you know, it's like, well, everyone else is having a go.
Yeah. It's almost like a doff of the cap to the actor, as you say. You know, it's all like, let's give Ewan something to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's fine. I quite enjoyed Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'm not saying it's the best thing I've ever seen. Far from it. And it completely, obviously, it does completely contradict so many things in Star Wars. But I kind of think that that's kind of closer to Star Wars than so many other things. I mean, I think because he's a character that is absolutely rooted in the kind of the Star Wars story. I think the trouble you have with Star Wars isn't really a universe. It's a story about Luke Skywalker, ultimately Darth Vader, and some of these other kind of ancillary characters. And the universe is just, you know, it's not very well sketched and not very well defined. And when you try to then kind of expand it into different areas, it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
It's not like Star Trek. Star Trek's a much better, kind of much more rigorously kind of like, it, the canvas of that is always broad, and it's not based around those kind of central characters. I mean, what the thing I think with the prequel films that does work with them is the fact that you're still dealing with those kind of core characters. It's the story of Darth Vader, it's the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi, whether it's the story you wanted them to tell in the way you wanted it told is, you know, that's a different discussion, but it's very much drawn from that. It's kind of, it's, they stack up, they're about something, whether you like them or not is not the kind of the point. That's a subjective response, but if you look at it objectively, there's a clear and coherent thing within all of that. There's a clear and coherent thing within the kind of original films. There's a clear and coherent thing within those original Indiana Jones films. But when you get to the, I mean, there's nothing in those new Star Wars films. That's, I mean, the only one that I think that actually works is Rogue One. And even that, I don't think works as well as people say. I think it works okay in the second half because there's some stakes that we know are up for grabs, and it does the best space battle since Return of the Jedi. But the first half of the film is a choppy mess.
Yeah.
And it gets better when Darth Vader appears.
Yeah. And I think at that point the bar had been lowered to the extent that we were quite happy to receive a moderately good film as a great film.
And that ending does
you know, cover a lot of sins.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, and I think that the action in that works well. It's got this kind of sense of it. It's got, also there's a thing in that with the kind of, I think the thing with it is the what's the kind of ethical and moral kind of thing that's driving the story. And in that, they've got to get the plans because they're going to fight rebellion and they're doing this. So there's the sacrifice is kind of for something that kind of, no one, you can't tell me what the stakes are in this, the J.J. Abrams, Rian Johnson, J.J. Abrams trilogy. I mean, we see a planet get destroyed, but what planet is it? Who's on there? How does this universe work? Who's the first? I don't understand who they are. First Order. Even now, I don't understand who they are.
Yeah. The First Order, but they come second. They come after the...
Exactly.
Can't we call them the Second Order? Wouldn't that be more... Right, let's get to some films that we liked, so that we're not always negging on these poor studios.
I think it's interesting though, because I think this all kind of like sits within the same kind of, it's all within the same kind of cinematic ecosphere, isn't it? Because if we're talking about Oppenheimer, the kind of the this should have been a film that Christopher Nolan made at Warner Brothers,
right?
Like every other film he's made in the last sort of 15 years or whatever. And yet it wasn't. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. And that partly is streaming. That's partly a change of management. That's change of position. I don't know if you saw the story recently. Apparently they paid him seven figures, Warner Brothers, for Tenet as a way to sort of make peace with him.
Right.
Just before this came out. So there's clearly been, some issues behind the scenes, and there's a reason why this is now a huge success for Universal rather than for Warner Brothers. In a year where Universal could have, you know, Warner Brothers obviously could have really used it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to put this in context,
to put this in context, I went to see this in Italy. I saw it in Italian, so but my Italian's great, and that obviously meant because of the dubbing, I didn't have any issues with the dialogue. Although the dubbing does tend to very much attempt to replicate the original sound design, and they're very good at it. You know, a voice on the radio sounds like a voice on the radio; it doesn't sound like a. The cinema was full on a Wednesday night in the summer in Italy, and that is
it's
the first night, and nobody goes to the cinema in Italy in the summer because everybody's at the sea. Everybody's in August. Right. Everybody's out of town. They're not in, you know. And the cinema was full, and I've never seen that. Usually, a Christopher Nolan film would come out in September, October. Even if it's come out everywhere else in July, it would come out in September, October, because that's when the cinemas are open and people are going back to see films. The cinema was full, and you just got this feeling that people were absolutely engaged in it, right? Fully. Personally, I just thought it was a masterpiece. I got halfway through and I had a couple of moments where I was thinking, I'm not sure that I like the way this is going. And then I think the film itself sort of turns around and answers those questions very effectively and is very slippy in the way it does that. And I think some of the criticisms I've heard lodged against this movie are kind of invited by the movie and then answered by the movie. I find it's like people have watched half the film or have formed their opinion before they've gone to see it and not actually been watching necessarily. What was your take on it, James?
The first time? I've seen it twice.
Right, okay. I'm going to definitely go and see it again on the big screen. There's no doubt about it.
First impressions. I thought this is probably his best film.
Right. What was your previous best film by him, by the way? That's always an interesting starting point.
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
He's like Kubrick, I think, in the sense that it's very difficult to put your finger on because he does different things very well, you know?
Yes. No, that's right. That's a hard one. It's a difficult one. I should say Memento. I don't know that I love Memento as a movie. I'd say The Prestige, maybe. But would it be The Dark Knight? Could it be Inception? I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of his films, full stop. I think I would say one of the great pleasures of my adult life has been watching him make films over a number of years. I mean, remember Philip French in a review reading that, saying that one of the great pleasures of his late life was seeing the films of Pixar, obviously the early 15, 20 years of it, and Christopher Nolan. And obviously he's got who kind of wrote the one of the big reviews to follow him, wasn't he, right at the start? I mean, I think in terms of his popular films, I think his Batman films are phenomenal. I don't think they'll never be, I don't think, surpassed with that character. That will be the high point. Because I think they're about something. They're about many things. They're very entertaining. They're great thrillers. They're great action movies. And they're great pieces of filmmaking as well. So there's a Paul Thomas Anderson quote, isn't there, where he said they're the highest form of commerce meeting the highest form of art. Cinematic art. And I think that's probably correct. And I think... Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough. I worked, did some of the comic stuff for The Dark Knight so it would have been 2007. And I read the script of The Dark Knight probably 9 months before it came out. And I've never been in that position where you go in and read the movie. And I had to do some stuff based around it. I had to adapt some bits, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, anyway, then the film comes out and you see it sort of 9 months later at the sort of press screening and everybody's kind of standing there cheering. I've never seen that at a press screening. Everybody's standing cheering at the end. And it living up to expectations. But also I remember reading it at the time thinking, this is great. I was quite agnostic about Batman Begins, I have to say, when I first saw it. Because I've been a huge kind of comic fan. It wasn't really made for me. Another thing, all the things that people found surprising, maybe in the kind of the movie going audience, were not really interesting to me. I'd seen those stories done before. I'd read the Denny O'Neill stuff. I'd seen the Neil Adams stuff. I'd seen the Frank Miller stuff. But I think The Dark Knight did something really kind of different. And then, but reading it on the page, it was kind of like a bit of a whoa. This is, it starts off, it's like a bit like what you were saying with Oppenheimer. It goes off on when you think, well, maybe it's some issues. And then it flips it around and solves those issues and answers those issues and goes into something that's very, very different and very bold. I think those films are terrific. I think what he did with Inception is terrific. I think Interstellar is very, very underrated.
Yeah, I agree.
I think from this is not so much what's my favourite, is that I think this is the culmination of the thing he's been working on since he finished the Batman movies. That's my feeling, is that there's, with the beginning of Interstellar, he moved to working with Hoyt van Hoytema. Slowly what he's been doing over the course of those films, he's been shedding the people he worked with before. So Lee Smith hasn't edited a movie since Dunkirk. Zimmer hasn't scored a movie since Dunkirk. He's kind of opened up and changed, and obviously Wally Pfister left with the last Batman film. So he's got a different kind of era of collaborators. And Ruth de Jong designed this, not Nathan. I mean, Nathan Crowley's designed most of his films, but not all of them. Ruth de Jong has come into this film. So there's a different kind of feel to some of the collaborators. I think Interstellar is a really underrated film. And I think he was going for something there that's very, very, that was very different. It was sold as being the next kind of Inception, and it's nothing like that.
No.
Not that sort of film at all. I think also what he's been dealing with in all these films is about this thing about Oppenheimer. Obviously, Oppenheimer was mentioned in Tenet, you know, the whole thing about, I think there's a big thing in his films now about being older and mortality and the fear of the planet. So you look at like Interstellar, it's a film about climate change, fundamentally.
Yeah.
If you look at Dunkirk, it's about this kind of all enveloping thing that you can't stop. You're trying to escape from this. There's this thing about escaping from this kind of crushing, whether that's the future, whether that's climate, whether that's the nuclear fear, all of these things. I mean, and I think in Tenet, that's that. I mean, that's almost like a horror movie.
Yeah, Tenet, again, I think is underrated. I think that
Tenet is a film that I think will be very much reappraised, because yeah. I think Tenet is a film.
Jackie Brown. I'm saying it now. That's his Jackie Brown.
Yeah, it's kind of his Blade Runner as well, I think. Mm. It's much more than, say, Inception or any of those. I think there's a loosening of the filmmaking. I think that's the thing that's been happening for a long time with the actors and he's also now seems to be fully in the mode of he's writing the screenplays himself. He's not working with his brother. Something about Interstellar is the beginning of that. Obviously, that's a Jonathan Nolan thing with him as well. But from there, from Dunkirk, Tenet, this, you're getting him much more back to what he was doing at the very early days of his career, you know, the kind of the followings, the mementos. He is writing these films and conceiving these films whole cloth. He's making them 3 years apart, not doing like one every 2 years or something like that, like he was at certain points. So there's a very controlled thing with the filmmaking, I think. But I do think there's a loosening. I think they're more character led. I mean, I think Tenet is interesting because it doesn't use any of the actors that he's used in the past. Maybe in a way that it's a kind of step back into kind of the sort of action blockbuster thing. But I think actually the thing I feel is that he's kind of moving away from that.
Oh yeah. I mean, Oppenheimer, I know all the publicity prior to Oppenheimer was it's going to be, they did this nuclear explosion without using CGI and yada, yada, yada. And I thought, well, that is an amazing scene. It's one of the, it's so well done, but it's not actually the explosion, which is well done. Exactly. And 99% of the film is not the explosion. So really, if that's all you're going for, you're not going to get much. And it's almost as if there's, what you're getting is an intense, highly spoken, highly complicated highly nuanced drama. It's a little bit like Dunkirk. I think Dunkirk played this trick, this sort of three-card Monty trick, where publicity-wise, where I think everybody was sold on the idea that it was going to be Saving Private Ryan. And it was sort of like aggressively bloodless. You know, it's like there's no blood in that film. And yet, it's almost like a throwdown of a gauntlet to retrospectively to Spielberg, saying I can make just as tense a movie about the Second World War and nobody gets their face blown off. And, you know, violence happens, but it's the violence of drowning. It's the violence of all these other things. It's the violence of the bullets that don't hit you.
Well, you know? He doesn't titillate with violence. He's never done that. He doesn't do that in any of the things. There's a horror. There's a huge amount of horror in Tenet with the kind of buildings going backwards, and that is that it's unnatural. There's
not bloody, uncanny.
Yeah, it's not right. There's something wrong. And there's seen it. I mean, I watched Dunkirk last night, actually, in preparation for this, mainly because it's 100 minutes. So it's easy to watch. I hadn't seen it in a couple of years. And what struck me about it is obviously it's hugely tense and the lurching horror of it. And there is very little blood. And there's very little overt violence. It's kind of like implied violence, a lot of it. I mean, and obviously there are moments when that hits. And it's very, as you know, the mechanics of like Wages of Fear and, you know, Hitchcock and, you know, some of Friedkin's films, you know, as well, you know, God rest him. There's an element of that very strongly played in that. But what I thought was interesting in that is that it's really kind of mad in terms of the structure. You've got the day, the week, the hour, sort of like playing, and then all collapsing. So it's very Rashomon in that sense. But it's also very, there's like dramas nested within the drama. You've got the story with the Tommies on the sea and the kind of stuff with the Frenchman inside who gets left behind and drowned in the thing and doesn't get away, does he? Yeah. And then you've got all the stuff with Tom Hardy stuff in the plane, but then you've also got all the stuff with Mark Rylance and Killian Murphy and Barry Keoghan on the boat, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliantly done. And I think also the coda when they come back at the end. And then obviously you've got Branner and all that doing their kind of little stuff on the pier.
Home? I mean, Branner in small doses is brilliant.
Yeah, he's used very well in Christopher Nolan's films. I think he's better when he's not directed by himself. He's a terrible actor when he's directed by himself.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he's a brilliant actor when he's used properly. But I think yeah, it's all kind of this, and then that whole kind of like sort of coming home stuff. I do think with Dunkirk was brilliant though. It is the only film that is also that manages to be a Christopher Nolan allo allo crossover.
Say again.
it's Christopher Nolan allo allo crossover.
Oh, who's the actor? Who is it?
Well, his aunt is Helga.
Of course, yes. Well,
he's married to his uncle Jonathan Nolan, who's at the end, who's in Batman Begins and all the other Batman films. But he's at the end. She's on the boat at one point. She's one of the nurses getting.
Oh my god!
Towards the end of the film.
There you go. Beautiful.
And if you read the screenplay of Dunkirk, there's an interview. It took back and forth between the two brothers talking about it, and then they tell a story about Auntie Kim being in the show of Hello, Hello, and a German guest. Coming around as someone dressed in an SS costume knocks on the door to say, "Is Kim there? We need to take her for the rehearsal," or something like that. Truly one of the best anecdotes I've ever seen.
What a world he lives in. What a world he's come from.
Totally bizarre, but kind of brilliant as well at the same time. And they address the Hello, Hello thing in that interview, which I think is really great as well.
Just one second. I'm just going to pause it. Also, the thing that I think is interesting about Dunkirk and Oppenheimer is that they're his two most commercially successful films, and yet it could be argued that they're his two sort of least obviously commercially attractive. You know, I mean, you have DiCaprio in Inception, you have the Batman films being massive, you know, franchise movies, you have... you know, even something like Insomnia is, you know, it's Al Pacino, it's Robin Williams, star power. And in these films, you don't have any... I mean, I got a bit of a
people came back at me for saying there's no real star power in Oppenheimer, but I don't see there is. I mean, Florence Pugh is not opening any movies. No one's saying, I mean, she's a great actress. I love her to bits, but she's got a bit part, you know. It's not, you know, and Cillian Murphy, likewise, is no one's, you know, look at him in Dunkirk, you know, he's playing a small role in a thing, and now he's leading a Christopher Nolan movie. I don't see, what do you think?
Well, I think that's the role. I think stardom's different, isn't it? I mean, I think you'd have to say, I mean, Robert Downey Jr., I think, carries a certain amount of weight, but does he open a film outside of being Iron Man or Sherlock Holmes? I mean, the Sherlock Holmes films are years ago, so outside of being Iron Man, nothing he's done has really made a huge. But he does give you.
There's
clever.
An accumulative thing, I think, of having so many people. That's true.
Yeah. And Matt Damon. So I think there is a collective star power, but it's a collective star power. It's not individual. It's not based around. I mean, Cillian Murphy is a different kettle of fish because he's really a character actor. I mean, I guess he's kind of like his status is different now as a result of Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
Or whether that doesn't necessarily translate into opening a giant movie. But I think you've got that accumulation of acting power throughout the kind of cast, which is very attractive. And, you know, I think this writers, the actor strike is obviously a very good example of this. I mean, June being moved as a result of that.
Just announced today.
Oppenheimer was able to really kind of leverage all that stuff just before the strike. You know, they did the red carpet, then the strike was called and they left, didn't they? So they were able to get all that. But the amount of material that's out there for them to kind of market based around, Emily Blunt sitting with Matt Damon or Cillian Murphy sitting with Robert Downey Jr. or that thing that was on Google or Wired, which was Christopher Nolan and Robert Downey Jr. together, which was hilarious.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
It's a strange thing to see. It was so kind of like good.
Those things are usually not that good. But
I know, they were quite, it was funny. It was really strange. It was the collision of these opposites. And yet, you know, I think there isn't the star power. I mean, I think that there is a kind of collective kind of like weight to it. But I think the appeal of the film is cross generational because I know. I mean, a lot of young people have gone to see it, which is clear. Partly that's the sort of Barbie thing. But I think I know a lot of. I mean, like my dad and his other half are in their mid-70s and they went to see it, loved it, and it's like. They wouldn't have gone to see a Christopher Nolan film 5 years ago.
Right.
Wouldn't have done it. So you look at that and you say, well, it's something. I think it's what's clever about it as a, I think is a piece of, you're right about it being a drama. It's a drama, but it's a thriller. It's in a way, it's kind of, we're talking about Dunkirk as a parallel. There's three dramas in Dunkirk that are kind of nested within each other. And that's true of Oppenheimer in a slightly different way. You've got this kind of historical kind of coming of age story, which could be a story in and of itself, where he's in Europe at the beginning and he's moving through.
They include the story about the apple, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And then you've got the middle section, which is the kind of the thriller, which is the kind of very similar to Inception, actually. It's putting the team together to do the stuff. It's like
exactly.
That
the where heist. They're
preparing the heist and all the rest of it. And then you've got this kind of courtroom drama, essentially, at the end, this drama with people in, you know, people in rooms, which in a way goes back to Following. That's what I thought watching it. It's like watched the beginning. Following is built around these three nested things, timelines. He's played with time before in other ways, but never really in this way since Following, which is that you've got this kind of like conversation. It's an interrogation, isn't it, in Following? His uncle and Jeremy. I can't remember the actor's name, who's the lead in that. And then the other spokes of the story kind of come off of that. But you've got that kind of intense kind of conversation across the table. And that's essentially what you've got in the scenes in the where Oppenheimer's being, you know, questioned. And then obviously the stuff with Strauss as well. So what struck me, I think as well, if you watch Oppenheimer and Dunkirk, there's a whole range of influences which I think are interesting. One of them is obviously the influence of Chariots of Fire on him. In terms of music, I mean, you listen to the music of Dunkirk, you listen to the music, particularly the music of Oppenheimer, there's a huge kind of Vangelis.
That's a really good shout. That's a very good shout.
And I think that the kind of Englishness of Dunkirk actually reminds me of the Englishness of Chariots of Fire, but also the kind of the rivalry between Strauss and Oppenheimer in a way. I know Amadeus has been the one that they've talked about, you know, people.
Salieri.
I think there's a lot of stuff between the stuff between Abrahams and Eric Liddell in Chariots of Fire. That's very much, you can see Chariots of Fire is a huge influence on the way they structure.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Did the Prestige as well.
I mean, Prestige is probably one of my favorites of Nolan's, and it's kind of interesting that I read the Christopher Priest book after I saw the film and much preferred the film. It was, you know, the Christopher Priest book's okay, it's good. I'm sure if I'd read it first, I would have been like, this is great. But after watching the movie, I was reading the book going, this is nowhere near as subtle and interesting and doesn't
I've
have
never read the book.
Yeah,
I've met Christopher Priest.
Right.
And the conversation I had, Chris, all he did was slag off Christopher Nolan.
Interesting.
I thought, I'm never going to read the book.
Yeah. He's.
That's a bit ungenerous of him. So.
Yes. Yeah. You'll never forgive someone who does you a good turn, I guess.
I think that's a huge kind of influence on it, and that texture and tone of Vangelis. I mean, there's obviously the Blade Runner thing as well. But I think, Nolan is very much in the vein of those filmmakers, you know, if you read the Tom Schoen book, you know, his dad was a kind of ad guy, wasn't he? Who kind of knew Ridley Scott and knew Hugh Hudson and knew Adrian Lyne. And you can see, I think there's a lot of Jacob's Ladder in Tenet.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of, and there's a lot of Chariots of Fire in a lot of Nolan's films. I think it's interesting is that the war in Oppenheimer as well, you've got the thing, there's a very American view of the war in Oppenheimer and there's a very British view of the war in Dunkirk. And I kind of feel he's, you know, you look at his sympathies, while he's the kind of half American, half British, but the British bit of him is really kind of powerful. And really comes through. That's the thing that gets me in Tenet is that you could be watching scenes in that could be drawn from when he was doing Following, you know, all the scenes of the little kind of back streets in London. Only someone who lived in London and kind of knows London would shoot in those kinds of places. There's an authenticity to that. And Elizabeth Debicki's character is very much a kind of a character the kind of social circles that they are, that him and Emma Thomas come from, that's a person they know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or
the scene with Michael Caine in the club where, you know.
Now, there's an honesty and a truth in Tenet. And I think all the stuff with Debicki and Branagh, that is such an English story because it's Abramovich.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And I've read an interview where he quite likes living in America. And he said, but Emma Thomas really yearns for home. And I think with him, there's a whole thing in this sort of sense of, what is America? What is Britain? And that's the tension that's in those kind of those filmmakers as well. Ridley and Hudson, they're British filmmakers, but they're kind of going for America. Tony Scott as well. Is the same.
But the interesting thing about Ridley and Tony is, and I do talk about them by their first names like that because we are pals. In Tony's case, we were. But
they never made a film in England. I mean, as in they never made a film, unless I'm skipping something. Maybe you could argue The Duelists, but not really. I mean, Ridley Scott doesn't make a British film. I'm not talking about the production, obviously. I'm talking about the setting. Whereas Nolan sort of, even when he makes Batman, you know, Batman lives in an English country house, that's supposed to be upstate New York.
Yeah, but I think that's because I think Ridley Scott and Tony Scott are Northern. The class thing is different.
Yeah.
Their classicism is about, I think they could not have become who they were. I mean, I did in advertising, but that there's a kind of on your uppers kind of Northern kind of striver element to them.
Mm.
I'm not knocking that. I think that's what gives the two of them a lot of the energy and power of their films and what drives them. But Nolan is someone of boarding school. You know, he's the upper class. You know, at the very least, he's the upper middle class. You know, it's like, and Emma Thomas is you know, she was going to either go into the diplomatic corps, and she ended up becoming a film producer. So, you know, that's,
or MI5.
Yeah, they're drawn from a very different kind of strata of English society. So I think what's interesting in that, he said, the public school politics allowed me to navigate the politics of Hollywood. I don't think he comes in as a salesman in the way that Ridley Scott comes in and says, I'm going to do this, and the way Tony Scott used to do that. I think he's much more political. I think that's the other thing that's really interesting in Oppenheimer is it's his most political film.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I can't think of another filmmaker who would feature as its main character a quasi-communist and elevates him, who would, I mean, you know, Warren Beatty made Reds and sort of, you know, would be...
Well, like Reds was interesting. I think Reds is a film I thought of with Oppenheimer.
Well, that's the last film I can think of that had a communist as a main character in a Hollywood movie.
I think, well, you'd have to go back to, I mean, to the left, you'd have to think of stuff like Good Night and Good Luck, maybe. And he's not communist.
Yeah, but he's not communist. That's a liberal, you know,
It's the last time I've ever heard anyone talk about sort of Harold Lasky in the...
Being a fellow traveller and supporting the Spanish Civil War. I mean, and all that stuff is obviously, you know, I've read the book American Prometheus, which is, you know, what Nolan's basing his screenplay off. And it's extremely, that's all in there. It's not, none of this is in any way. In fact, I that's where I think criticism of the treatment of Gene Tatlock is wrong. I mean, and his wife is wrong, Kitty. Those characters are kind of who those people were. That's not him sort of reducing them to types or this, that, or the other. In fact, I thought in both those cases, because of the quality of the actresses involved, they were really rich, deep characters. I didn't see, other people had said, oh, you know, the first time a woman speaks is 20 minutes into the film, and then the next scene she's having a sex scene. I just thought, well, Jesus Christ, that the fact that you're counting the minutes and you're doing a sort of Bechdel test on it is a very narrow way of approaching cinema, I think.
Or anything.
Yeah, exactly. If we're going to do a numbers game,
it's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, the Tatlock thing is, she's not a she's a major part of it. She's a small part, but she's a very important part.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the thing for Emily Blunt. I mean, it's totally under sort of like statement about Emily Blunt, because she's like in the background. If you watch the scene where he's being questioned and she's sitting behind him, and she's kind of doing whatever she's doing with her hands, you know, she's there.
Yeah.
Someone doesn't say anything in a scene doesn't mean they're not like stealing the scene or not hugely important. And also there's a reason she sat behind him as well. That's what's fascinating about it is if you watch that film and say it's all about the kind of the foregrounding and, you know, the valor of the white man, you haven't watched the second half of the film. It's about the absolute destruction. And there's the bit where she grabs him, isn't there, where she says she can't commit the sin and then kind of like, I can't remember what the line is, but you absolve yourself of the guilt, you know, with that. And she kind of basically slaps him back into thing. And he goes to see his mate and he says, we're terrible, selfish people. It's like, that's because people can be terrible, selfish people. You know, it's that's unfortunately the way people are. You know,
who he then sells down the river, if you're paying attention, he then completely betrays. And I love the fact that in many ways that role that Emily Blunt has as Kitty is set up to be, in the worst version of this film, would be the supportive wife who says, when you've done this, Robert, come back to your family. But instead is a woman who drinks way too much and doesn't like her children, you know, and has no maternal feelings and thinks, I can't, you know, I've been with him all day, you handle it. Every time you see the babies, they're screaming, you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't set up a dichotomy of domestic bliss that you're sacrificing versus the world of work, which is more active and interesting to you and more morally complex. It's just like, no, you're not going to get any, you know, he was friends to animals and small children. That's not going to come in like it would, as I say, in a worse film.
Well, brilliance goes a long way, but there's a great line, isn't it? It's the line later on where he said it's about a third of the way through, not even a third of the way through, it's in the opening part of the film where he talks about, you know, the you know, what is it that when they're black, we talk about black holes and it's like the gravity pulls all the light in as it's dying, like a dead star or a dying star or whatever. And that's the film, because the second half of the film is he's the dying star after the explosion. And that's why the second half of the film's in black and white.
Yeah.
It's like, I've never seen that, not seen anyone mention that at all.
That's
like
really interesting, yeah.
Woven into the fabric of the whole thing is that what you've got is a story about a human life. And I think that's one of the things that's really kind of powerful and moving about the film. It's, you know, it's about this kind of fire of intelligence. I mean, it's mythical as well. I mean, that's why it's called American Prometheus. I mean, I wonder if Ridley Scott hadn't made Prometheus, whether he'd have called it Prometheus.
Yeah, because it even has the title explained at the beginning, even though not... I think you're absolutely right. I think it would definitely be called Prometheus without that, or American Prometheus like the book. I also thought it was very interesting right at the beginning that it had those subtitles of fission and fusion, and you thought, oh, okay, here we're going to get like a Dunkirk thing, and those are right at the beginning and are not sort of mentioned, but they sort of organize those two strands of his interview and the interview with Schutz.
Well, that's right. And I think that it is like Dunkirk in that sense. It's that it's a double strand rather than a triple strand. You've got, you know. And yeah, I mean, the kind of the difference between fission and fusion is that kind of, you know, what you do, you crack open. I mean, I wonder how much of an... I mean, the filmmaker that I think he's a huge influence on him, which is massively under kind of discussed, is David Lynch. I think he talks about that. And I think if you watch Tenet, I think, you know, there's red rooms and blue rooms. There's blue and red. You know, it's like it could be the red room in Twin Peaks. You know, you've got the blue room, which is very like the stuff in Blue Velvet. You've got people wearing masks, like Frank in Blue Velvet. You've got people talking backwards and moving backwards, like in the red room in Twin Peaks. I mean, it's like...
That's very interesting.
Yeah, clear.
I would never think of him as a... I mean, that's the other thing is I've never seen a film, and here I would compare it to, say, The Theory of Everything, a film that I didn't like, where the idea of thinking about stuff was actually visualized in a compelling way. So when you see the idea of, you know, when he mentions the quantum field and you actually see a lot of abstract images on the screen, that actually struck me. And here I would compare him, hopefully he's not going to be buried under all these people we're comparing him to, but here I would compare him maybe someone like Terry Malick doing, looking at the universe and saying, okay, how does the universe work on a macro level and a micro level? And that to me was much better than sort of, you know, Eddie Redmayne, you know, stirring a cup of coffee and going, oh, spirals, maybe that's like a galaxy.
Well, it's open. This film, it's interesting. The film opens with the raindrops, and which is a very Malick kind of shot, a kind of a very Tarkovsky type of top shot as well. And that's not in the script. They added that in the edit. That's like in the script.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was in the fire, and it starts with, but it starts with water first, and the nature. And it's perfect because that then ties to the end where you've got the vision of the kind of the explosions in the atmosphere, all of these drops.
Yeah, that's on the maps.
I mean, yeah, no, I think the visualization of abstract ideas and also the transformation of abstract ideas into an emotional response. I think it's a very, very emotional film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really, really powerful. And that's why I think the connection to kind of Interstellar is there. And that's why I think it's true in the other thing in Dunkirk and Tenet. I think there's a huge amount of like, there's a great, that great scene in Tenet where she sits down and talks to John David Washington in the restaurant and lays it out.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And that's kind of where his films have kind of been going. And I think you see that kind of reach fruition in Oppenheimer. But to go back to what we said about Malick, I think Malick is right. I mean, if you go back to Interstellar, the kind of the collapse of the natural environment, all the dust clouds. Yes, there's a bit of Stalker in there as well, but you know, that's, there's a lot of Tarkovsky in the way Malick approaches nature.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I think also there's a tradition of filmmaking that's there with Terry Malick, that's there in David Lynch. And that is in people like Jack Fisk, the production designer.
Right.
And his assistant was Ruth De Jong, who designed Oppenheimer. And she designed with Fisk There Will Be Blood, which is the other film, I think, which has got all the stuff in Los Alamos, I think, reminds me of that.
Yeah, very the sense funny. Of a community being built up, an yes, industry yes, yes. coming from nowhere.
And these tensions. In that, it's kind of capitalism and religion. In this, it's kind of the military and science kind of yep. like smashing together.
The military-industrial yeah. complex, you know, which yeah. is built
And also,
on...
Ruth De Jong was the production designer on Twin Peaks.
Oh, man.
And you look at the episode 8 with the kind of the explosion.
No, exactly. Yeah. Episode, someone put that in.
Also, his kind of abstract kind of the imagery, it was made me think of when you go into that, which Lynch did, you know, that kind of Stan Brakhage. I mean, Lynch goes much more into the kind of Stan Brakhage kind of experimental kind of look of all that stuff. But there's a lot of that in this. And I think that that's, I think he's a huge influence on him. And I think in his use of sound and in use of music. And I think, yeah, I think that there's, and I think, but I do think there's been a big change in the films with the change in editorial. I think the fact Jennifer Lama is editing the films, you can feel they're different. They're like coiled springs, I think, with the Lee Smith films.
I think this was one of the best edited films I've seen in a long time. I mean, it was so complicated. And it was so seamless. I wasn't for a second confused. I was totally into it. And to the point that I wasn't noticing, we were jumping between 20, 30 years regularly within three shots. I would add another thing about the David Lynch, Jack Fisk connection with Terrence Malick as well, is, you know, they're all at the AFI at the same time, Lynch and Malick are. And I would also, thinking about how they're visualizing power and you know, atomic processes, Lynch, from the very beginning of his career, is fascinated by electricity and how electricity is something that we just take for granted and is actually this terrifying force that surrounds us, and we're using it to power our lives. But, you know, the crackling electricity is a trope that he uses. And I think in Oppenheimer, that electricity becomes a sort of quantum world of energies and forces and strong nuclear force.
Well, and also you go back to the Prestige. Tesla,
exactly. Yeah, very, very. So, good.
You know, and also Bowie is in Twin Peaks.
Oh, damn it! Have we ever seen Nolan and Lynch in the same room?
No. He doesn't talk about him in the Nolan variations. Not a lot. Everybody kind of looks at him. I mean, I always thought with like Memento and stuff like that, when you looked at his version of America, it feels to me very Lynchian.
Yeah.
I
think there's hotel rooms and diners.
There is in Insomnia as well. There's a kind of sense of that. There's also with,
but then those are both drinking from the same noir well. So there's a little crossover.
I think in Inception there's a certain amount of, it's not Lynch in some respects, but there's a Lynchian kind of idea that's in there. But I also think with him, it's Cronenberg as well, because if you look at Memento, you can look at that and say that's very like a Cronenberg film with the tattoo in and the loss of memory. Mm. The scene in Inception, isn't there, where they're all kind of sleeping, which is very similar to a scene in what's the film?
Existence,
yes, but also Naked Lunch, where they're in they get with the mugwumps. This is where they're going into the, they come here to kind of get the drink off the mugwumps. I think it's towards the end.
And then you can look at
Dead Ringers and see a kind of very strong connection with like something like The Prestige, with the two characters and the twins and the, you know, there's a lot of those filmmakers that are never talked about in terms of his work, which I think are really deeply embedded, because Cronenberg's a very literary filmmaker in the way that he's a very literary filmmaker.
Yeah.
But Lynch is a very emotive filmmaker in the way that he's a really emotive filmmaker.
Yeah.
People talk about him in the kind, I mean, he's kind of unusual. I mean, he's kind of unique really as a filmmaker in the world, in that what he brings to the mainstream is kind of what no one else in the mainstream does. Because you can look at it and say, yeah, there's a very strong James Cameron influence. There's a very strong, influence of Ridley Scott and all the rest of it, but his films aren't really like their films.
No, not at all, not at all. And I think in the depth of complexity, I mean, I enjoy James Cameron, but I wouldn't look at Avatar and think I'm going to go there to think. You know, I mean, it's got stuff going on, but I wouldn't. It's Harry Harrison. It's not Philip K. Dick.
No, that's right. Well, David Cronenberg is that. That's where you go to David Cronenberg for that. Mm. And to be honest, you get a much better kind of adaptation of Philip K. Dick from David Cronenberg than you would from Ridley Scott.
Right, right.
Because Ridley Scott would adapt the world, but he doesn't really get the Philip K. Dick.
No. Philip K. Dick is too 60s and too sort of countercultural.
Whereas a film like Videodrome or a film like Existence is Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
It's not a Philip K. Dick story, but it's absolutely drawn from it. Like, there's more... In a weird way, there's more of Philip K. Dick in something like Total Recall than there is in Blade Runner.
Yeah. No, I definitely... The Taxi Driver is a classic Dick character. One thing I want to say before we finish up with Oppenheimer, which is one other criticism. We've already talked about the sexism that has been perceived, which I would push back strenuously. I'd also argue that there's this argument that we don't see... the result of the atomic bombs. We don't see the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm. I would add, you don't see any of the Second World War. You don't, I mean, again, for me, a lesser film would have him sitting in a cinema, watching, you know, German troops walk into Warsaw and going, or seeing some sort of the Jews being, harassed on the street after Kristallnacht and sort of saying, okay, we're going to have to do something about these guys. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That the whole thing, even when they're talking about the Nazis, we need to get this before the Nazis. It's almost ranked as a scientific competition with his, you know, the flashback you get is to him meeting Heidenberg. It's not to him, not to him experiencing anti-Semitism. That's spoken about, but it's not, you don't see that. It's not part of his lived experience. He hears about it from another character. And he even sort of, when he meets that character, sort of said, you know, is kind of like, well, I don't really think about my Jewishness much. You know, I'm not, that's not part of my identity to a great extent. And so you have this this criticism that somehow the film betrays the people of Japan because it doesn't, I think it's just utterly misguided, because that choice of not seeing that is because you get all the results of that much more powerfully by not seeing some sort of Terminator 2 shot of Nagasaki being blown up. You know, I think you get it. You get the excitement of them putting the team together and getting the bomb together and the excitement of the test. And right at that moment where they're all triumphing, you feel uneasy and queasy, and the film feels queasy, you know, take the sheet in. And from then on, you are
constantly feeling that this is screwed up. And you, somebody said in a review that they wrote that was very negative, said, oh, it's not made clear that Germany is already out of the war. It's mentioned like four times in the course of the film prior to the bomb being tested, being dropped on Hiroshima. Germany has surrendered, Germany has surrendered, Germany has surrendered. Maybe three times, but it's there in the movie. There's no sense that... What's your take on it?
Well, I think also there's a shift, isn't it? There's that scene where Oppenheimer comes in to the room where they're having their meeting, and they say that Germany are out of the war. Why are we still doing the bomb at this point? He says, we can't let the Russians have... Doesn't he say we can't let the Russians have it? It's
yeah,
like...
Yeah, it's... Yeah. And I mean, like... that, by the way, that isn't necessarily, you know, conspiratorial Americans, terrible Americans. I mean, Stalin was working on the bomb, and if Stalin got the bomb, you know,
Let's put it this way. The stakes of this film are not a Twitter post.
Yeah.
I mean, people have to kind of like... And politics is about more than just... And the film is about power in every single sense. Yeah. Who has power? Who leverages power? The scene that sums that up better than everything else is the bit after they've detonated the bomb, and then Grove said, and he says, when I come to Washington, he said, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why would you? It's like you're useful, and his mate earlier on says to him, they won't, what about when they, or when they're interviewing the scientists, he says, well, what about when they don't need you anymore? And that's a great thing. It's about power. It's about power in every sense. He's unleashing power, but the power you unleash is not the power that you're necessarily going to use. Who is going to use it? I mean, the scene with Gary Oldman is kind of amazing,
unbelievably good. And that thing of like saying as the door is closing, I don't want to see that guy.
One criticism of the film though is that he looks more like Alan Mullery than he does Harry Truman.
Gary, he does love his makeup, doesn't he? Bless.
It's a great scene. It's phenomenal. And it's like, that's the one time he comes into real direct conflict with power or confrontation with power. And he's reduced to a child. Yeah. He's treated as a child. He's emasculated. And was it, get that crybaby out of here?
Yeah.
I dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, it's like, and that is... You know, and Truman is a great, in many ways, is a great president. If we look at it kind of in the broader scheme of things, you know, Truman did that thing. There's a debate about the dropping of the bomb in Japan. Is that would the Japanese have surrendered? You know, if they hadn't dropped the bomb, that you're talking about hundreds of thousands of lives that would have been lost in trying to take Japan. You can argue the toss with that. I mean,
that argument has largely been settled, I think.
I think it's a complicated debate. I think the point is it's not reducible to just saying you don't see the Japanese, but it's like you can, but would you ever adequately express the horror on a film, on a movie screen? I mean, Hiroshima Mon Amour maybe does that with Renee using real footage from Japan at that time.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the film has the opportunity to do that. I mean, the one thing I'd say historically, I think it's been fairly settled that the Japanese were in negotiations for a total surrender, and the Americans were actually pushing it off because they wanted to use the bomb to show Stalin that they had it. The second thing though is when you have that scene where they're looking at the consequences, they're going through it like as a almost like a, you know, debrief, and this is what was happening to people who were this far away from the explosion, and this is what and that's the point. Nolan could easily show those pictures and we would go, oh my God, but we just focus on his reaction. It's just what it's doing to him. And I think that's a really conscious decision. I'm not saying that necessarily makes it a good thing, but it's not that he's just forgotten about the Japanese. He knows that he's got an opportunity here where he can show the images of the Japanese, the devastation that a bomb wrought, and do it within the rules that he has provided for the sort of subjectivity of his camera. He doesn't do it, I think, because he's trying to get to an even bigger point, which is not only the suffering that this caused the Japanese, but how this is to this present day endangering the entire world.
Well, and it poisons the world, and it poisons the United States. I think that's the kind of scene with Truman, isn't it? You know, this is like, who are the good guys here? Who are the bad guys here? But also that once the genie's out the bottle, you can't put it back in. And this is true of all forms of technological advancement. And you know, the thing with Oppenheimer as well, it's also about ambition. I think this is the thing that's interesting with the comparison with Dunkirk, is what you have in Dunkirk is there's no central character. It's a collective effort to kind of survive the war. So the war there, from a sort of British point of view, is a collective endeavor. You know, that's why, you know, it's interesting, you know, talking about the sort of like the Tories after the war. One of the reasons why a lot of the Tories, the wets in Thatcher's cabinet, couldn't really be aggressive against the working class in Britain is because they'd served with them in the war.
Right.
All of the Thatcherite kind of stuff happens after there is a massive sea change in the kind of the nature of the Conservative Party. People who didn't follow, like the Willie Whitelaws of this war world, who were like tank commanders, and those guys had been their friends and had died alongside them. When they're kind of out the way, then the kind of, you get this kind of much more aggressive kind of class war. So that's a very embedded kind of like notion of the war in the UK. I think it's interesting in Oppenheimer that it's about an individual. That's a very American view.
Yeah,
I dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. It's the kind of the focus on the individual, the focus on the great man kind of idea.
And in many ways,
what the film is really clever at doing is undercutting that.
Yes, exactly.
It's totally not the opposite of like American triumphalism. It's totally the opposite of that. And it's like Einstein says to him at the end, you know, whatever, in that little scene, you know, they gave me my little kind of award, and they're really, it's there for them, not for you. And it's kind of,
yeah.
And that's heartbreaking, the scene at the end when it's there. And then you see her not shake Teller's hand because of, you know, that's fantastic. But the point of Oppenheimer is he's a great man, but also a terrible man, and he's a strong man, and he's a weak man. He's all of these. He's a man. Yeah. That's the point.
He's incredibly rational, and he's also insane. I mean, there's processes in this, and he always was. I mean, the thing with the apple, you don't poison your professor's apple just because he screwed with you in the laboratory. That's a ridiculous act.
Man of rationality, and a man of passion, and a man of appetites, and a man, and all those kinds of things, and that's the thing about the film. It's not this reduction. I mean,
a casual thing where he admits to sort of screwing one of his best friend's wives. And it's just like, oh, yeah.
Which is sort of subtly hinted at in the film, but never kind of confirmed until that point. And it's a throwaway thing. But it's there's the whole thing in it as well, though, isn't there? I think this thing of the kind of American exceptionalism. I think it's totally. One of the things I don't like about Saving Private Ryan, and I don't like about Schindler's List, is that you reduce these horrors to a sort of like a melodrama. And I think it's famously that it's that thing that Kubrick said about the Schindler's List, isn't it? That only Stephen could turn the greatest failure in human history into a success story.
Yeah, the feel good movie. You know,
it's like. Yeah,
I mean, I'm Holocaust
not in the kind of the quality of the filmmaking or any of that, or the acting, but I do have a problem with that. I always have that. I don't think Spielberg as a filmmaker really has ever stood up. He can do that. I don't think he delivers on the promise of those kind of films. I find those films far less human and engaging and interesting than he's more kind of, you know, sort of like a throwaway.
Or
I mean, to be honest, I find sort of Belloc kind of a much more kind of understandable, nastier kind of villain than, say, Goeth in sort of Schindler's List. I find, you know, that's just sort of, you know, not that Ralph Fiennes is not a great actor and that's not a really good performance, but I don't know, there's an element with all those films, it's just you don't buy it. You just don't buy it. I think that's the problem I have with that.
The same is true of Amistad as well, I think, is
They're kind of very, and the same with Lincoln as well. It's like that's a very kind of stolid, staid, kind of uninteresting film in lots of ways.
It's a really superior TV movie with two amazing performances at its heart. You know, it's Tommy Lee Jones and Daniel Day-Lewis sitting together and acting it out, and it's just gorgeous. But yeah, I mean, going back to, so for when you said, I thought that was absolutely right what you say, this Ayn Rand idea of the individual, this powerful man who's going to dictate history, and Atlas Shrugged and all the rest of it. And yet at the end, I loved the line with Robert Downey Jr. where he's obsessing over Einstein not saying anything to him. And the sort of the cabinet aide, the government civil service guy, just says, maybe they had more important things to think about.
Exactly.
And I just thought that summed up the film. This whole human melodrama that Spielberg would have given a line that justified that. And then you go back and obviously we're spoiling everything here. The line that I loved and which devastated me was, you remember when I asked about, you know, us destroying the world? Well, we did, you know, I think we did. Mm-hmm. And I just think that isn't about that. That's, to me, is about the nuclear threat. It's about the present day situation with climate crisis. And it just struck me as almost like, Jesus Christ, could this be, if you shot this film out on some sort of solar satellite that would just go out into the world and aliens would pick it up from millennia, this would be the film that would say, this is why they're all dead. This is why they died out. This is a requiem for the human race.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think the shadow of it as well is what goes. I think what's interesting in that bit, it's maybe they were talking about things that were more interesting, but also that it's Kennedy who is the vote, the junior senator from Massachusetts who, you know, screws Strauss over. And at the same, and then, but Kennedy will be defined by the nuclear issue.
Yeah. The Cuban missile crisis.
Yep. It will be, and that will kind of like, and the war on communism, all these things kind of like, it doesn't end. These things continue. These things kind of continue to metastasize within the American body politic as time goes on. I really like Strauss in the film. I think there's a thing there as well about, I think there's an interesting thing there about two types of Jew as well in America.
Yes.
You've got the assimilated one, and Strauss can't hide the fact he's a Jew. Now, they have that conversation about, you know, that he's at the temple, isn't it? He goes to such and such temple in town when he's trying to kind of flatter Oppenheimer to get him to come to the Institute. And Oppenheimer treats him like an absolute piece of shit. You know, he's like, so you can kind of understand Strauss's sort of antipathy towards Oppenheimer. And when he's in charge of the Atomic Energy Commission, you can see the point about they're talking about with the Russians. They're talking about, you know, he ran a leaky ship and the Russians got this information. So Strauss is not a villain in the same way.
No, not at all.
He's an interesting character as well because of his as a politician, but also that those two kind of faces of science and politics. You know, we talk about, you know, science and military, but science and politics. He's a military man as well before, wasn't he, Strauss? So I think that's his background. So you've got that going on.
But I also
two views of assimilation, I think, are really important as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think also that last line of, you know, maybe they were talking about something more important, also serves as a kind of an explanation for the Jason Clarke interrogation scenes, which run throughout, that, you know, what this guy has done, he's so guilty. This, you know, little procedure in a small room doesn't
that's not important either. I mean, it's played out as one of the main, you know, are they going to, oh, wow, they're going to triumph on or not?
It also as and well, it's like, but it's also the other thing she says, why don't you fight back? And it's because he thinks he deserves it.
Exactly. Yeah. He wants punishment and the punishment isn't being given to the extent that he wishes. He'd rather this be televised and be humiliated all over the world. And, you know, it's not going to happen. And I love Jason Clarke in this. I think he does really good job. And that thing of bringing out that moral failing, you know, you don't deserve, the justifications you have are wrong, you know. And
I think Matt Damon's great as Groves as well. I think there's a great, their relationship at the center of the film is great. But I think when he comes and speaks at the hearing is really, that's a very, very moving scene without being overdone. And I just think Cillian Murphy's performance is phenomenal because it's so much of it is reaction.
Yeah,
certainly in that stuff where he's kind of, you've got the main character who's kind of, you know, essentially not doing very much in that final bit. Everybody's basically raining. But the way he plays it is kind of like phenomenal. It's phenomenal old age makeup as well.
Yeah,
it's like sometimes you see that in films and it's just crap.
Yeah, yeah. But he looks really wizened and, you know, the cancer's going to get him very soon.
The way it's done. I mean, it's just, it's just...
Who would have thought he would have died of cancer after all those cigarettes?
Didn't he?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He died. 16,
when his daughter killed herself, didn't she, as well? Yeah, so the tragedy of it kind of like lingers through.
Absolutely.
Throughout. But I think also the other thing that I find interesting as well, and particularly with this, is and I think this is true, you've mentioned this, I know you're doing your book on Malick. You mentioned it before about him being viewed as a Christian. I think with Nolan, that's very strong. And I think in this, it's very strong, even going from the apple, you know, you could argue the apple and set this apple, the apple and the serpent, they talk about this don't raise the rock when it comes out. That idea of guilt and sin and deliberately biting the fruit, you know, to take that, you know, knowledge is interesting the way it's played, that it's knowledge kind of takes you, it's the human story. It's the way that kind of, those things are kind of framed. What is correct? Are you, you know, that classic idea in movies, isn't it? You're tampering with the laws of nature, you know. I'd love to see him make a horror film. That's what I'd love to see him do.
Wow. And a musical. I'd love him go through all the genres because I think he's already done. I mean, I think that's what he did with Batman. He basically did a bit of a horror movie with Batman Begins. He did a bit of a Michael Mann crime thriller. And then I don't know what he did with Dark Knight Rises. What was that? It's kind of opera.
I think that's his most underrated film.
It's a disaster movie. Yeah, that's a good call. I'll go with that.
I think that's his most underrated film.
Oh,
my favorite Batman film, actually, of the three.
Wow. Well, I'm much maligned, but I definitely loved it. I was definitely. Listen, James, that's absolutely brilliant conversation. I really enjoyed talking those things over with you. You've opened my mind to loads of new points of comparison and points of connection. I can't wait to go and watch it again on Monday.
Brilliant. Will you watch it in? You're going to only see it in Italian, or you?
No, hopefully it'll be in English on Monday, and so I'm going to take my daughter to see it, who's a big, huge fan of cinema, and I think we're going to enjoy it. Yeah, brilliant, James. Thanks so much, man.
Pleasure.
And we've got to talk. James Gunn and Alan Moore. I think we've got to do an Alan Moore.
I think we were going to do that, weren't we? Yeah.
That's still on the docket.
Yeah. Well, you let me know, and we'll fit it in.
Brilliant. Take care, man.
You too. Thanks, John.
Fact, A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.